the title of this episode, A Fascinating Tale, it relates to something that we're going to take a look at in the last half of the episode, and something most Christians have never heard and really ought to be shared. We'll begin the episode with this. What comes to mind when you hear the word liturgy? Now, it has different associations for different people. Some find great comfort in a liturgy because it recalls a time in their life of close connection to God. Others think of empty rituals that obscure rather than bring closer a sense of the sacred. The following is by no means meant as a comprehensive review of Christian liturgy. Far from it. That would take hours. This is really just a thumbnail sketch of the genesis of some of the liturgical traditions of the church. Now, using a broad brush, liturgy refers to the order and the parts of a service held in a church. Though most non-denominational evangelical churches, like the one that I'm a part of, don't call our order of service on a Sunday morning a liturgy, that is in fact what it is. Technically, liturgy means service, but it's come to refer to all of the various parts of a church service. It includes the order the various events occur, how they're conducted, what scripts are recited, what music is used, which rituals are performed, even what physical objects are employed. Things like, well, special clothes, furniture, and implements. Even within the same local congregation, there may be different liturgies for different events and seasons of the year. For sake of convenience in explaining, churches are put into two broad categories, liturgical and non-liturgical. Liturgical churches are often also called high church, meaning that they have a set of traditions for the order of the service that includes special vestments for priests and officiants, and follows a pattern for services that's been conducted the same way for decades, and in some cases for centuries. Certain portions of the Bible are read, then a reading from another treasured tome of that denomination, while people sit, stand, or kneel at designated times as the clergy follows a set route through the sanctuary. In a non-liturgical church, while they may have a regular order of service, there's little of the formalism and ritual that's used in a high church service. In many liturgical churches, the message that a pastor or a priest shares each week, well, it's spelled out by the denominational hierarchy in a manual that's sent out annually. In a non-liturgical church, the pastor is typically free to pick what he wants to speak on. The great liturgies arose in the 4th to the 6th centuries, and then were codified in the 6th and the 7th. These liturgies were much more elaborate than the order of service practiced in the churches of the 2nd and 3rd centuries. And several factors led to the creation of liturgies. First, well, there was a tendency to settle on a standard way to say things when it comes to the beliefs and practices of a group. When someone states something well or does something in an impressive way, it tends to get repeated. And second, bishops and elders tended to take what they had learned in one place and transplanted it wherever they went. Third, a written liturgy made the services simply more orderly. Fourth, the desire to hold on to what was thought to be passed down by the apostles became a priority, and this worked against a desire for change. Fifth, a devotion to orthodoxy combined with a concern about heresy, well, it tended to sanctify what was old and opposed innovation. Changes in a liturgy sparked controversy. The main liturgies that emerged during the 5th and 6th centuries bear similarities in structure and theme, even in wording, while also having distinct features. The main liturgical traditions can be listed as, in the East, the Alexandrian, or sometimes called the Egyptian liturgies. The West Syrian family of liturgies include the Jerusalem, Clementine, and the Constantinopolitan liturgies. There's a tongue twister for you. The East Syrian family includes the liturgies that were used in the Nestorian churches of the East. Now, in the West, the principal liturgical families were Roman, Gallican, Ambrosian, Celtic, and Mozarabic, a tradition that was drawn from the church in the Iberian Peninsula, the region of modern Spain. As we saw in the episode on Pope Gregory the Great, in the 7th century, Gregory embellished the liturgies and rituals that were practiced in the Western Church. Elaborate rituals were already a longtime tradition in the Eastern Church, influenced as it was by the court of Constantinople. Now, if Augustine laid down the theological base for the medieval church, it was Pope Gregory who can be credited with its liturgical foundation. But Gregory didn't invent things out of a vacuum. There was already extensive liturgical fodder for him to draw from. And that brings us to the fascinating tale of the 4th century document that's called the Pilgrimage of Etheria, sometimes called the Travels of Egeria. Now, we're not sure who she was, but we can narrow down to either a nun or a well-to-do woman of self-sufficient means from northern Spain. She toured the Middle East between 381 and 384, and then wrote a long letter to some women that she calls her sisters and friends, chronicling her 3-year adventure. While the beginning and end of the letter are missing, the main body gives a detailed account of her trip, made from her extensive notes. The first part describes her journey from Egypt to Israel, where she traveled extensively in what at that time was called Palestine, and then north into Syria and Asia Minor, through Mesopotamia, and ending at Constantinople. The second and much longer section, well, that's a description of traditions surrounding her pilgrimage. It has a detailed account of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. She describes its services, liturgical practices, even the physical layout of the church and other holy sites that she visited. What's remarkable in reading her account is the tremendous sense of freedom and safety that Etheria seems to have had as she traveled over long distances in hostile environs. She was accompanied for a time by soldiers, and no doubt these provided a measure of security. But that she felt safe with them, with the soldiers, is remarkable and speaks to the impact the faith already had on the morality of the ancient Middle East. Remarkable as well was the large number of Christian communes, monks, bishops that she met on her travels. Every place mentioned in the Bible already had a shrine or a church. And as she visited each, using her Bible as a guide, she was shown dozens of places where, you know, this or that biblical event was supposed to have occurred. Now, I've been to the Holy Land many times. I know the sites that have long claimed to be the place where, you know, this or that Bible story unfolded. Most of them are at best a guess. What I found fascinating about Etheria's account is that already by the end of the 4th century, most of these sites boasted to be the very place. And I have to wonder if the obligatory souvenir shop was also hawking wares at each location. They certainly are today. The old adage that is that you exit through the gift shop, it certainly applies to the Holy Land. Now, you can't read Etheria's chronicle without being impressed with how thoroughly the church had covered the Middle East in just 300 years, even in some isolated locations, places that are just mentioned in passing in the account of the Exodus. Every little town and village found in the Old and the New Testaments had a church or a memorial and a group of monks ready to tell the story of what had happened there. Now, 300 years may seem like a long time, but remember that almost all of that time was marked by the persecution of Jesus' followers. Etheria's account of the liturgy of the church in Jerusalem, which occupies the bulk of her record, is interesting because it reveals an elaborate tradition for both daily services and special days like the Holy Week of Easter. They observe the hours in the Holy Service, marking off the day in different periods of devotion led by the Bishop of Jerusalem. Now, traditional history tells us that the idea of a liturgical year was only just beginning in Etheria's time. Her description of the practices of the Jerusalem church community makes clear that the liturgical year was already well along, and it had been for some time. Written in common Latin of the 4th century, the Pilgrimage of Etheria was lost to time and only discovered in Arezzo, Italy, in 1884 by Gianfrancesco Gamarini. It's been a source of great insight to historians about the Latin of that time, as well as giving you a unique perspective on the daily and spiritual lives of people in that period of the Roman Empire. It appears to have been the source of much information to pilgrims of the medieval period that were planning trips to the Holy Land. As a woman traveler and writer, Etheria's account is immensely significant for understanding women's roles in early Christianity. Her ability to undertake such an extensive journey and her level of education challenged long-held assumptions about the status of women in that time. If you're interested in reading Etheria's account yourself, you can find it at the link that's in the description below.